Believers got to understand what evolution is if they're going to talk about evolution. Believers have a problem discussing things that are related to science because they don't often understand science. Their understanding of science is frequently insufficient to really sustain them in the issue. Let me give you an example. Believers like to pull out the second law of thermodynamics as a gotcha argument. And I think sometimes they feel like, if I whip this out, you can't say anything, gotcha. And that's not correct. And they'll say things like, second law of thermodynamics says things break down, therefore DNA cannot come together and cannot become more complicated because things break down. And they see this as this big, last word argument. The problem is, then the evolutionists turn around, and the evolutionist says, if you introduce energy from outside the system, then you can do that. And the believer is often left scratching his head because he doesn't actually, number one, know what that really means, and number two, get how that can happen. And in that argument, neither side actually really gets either side's argument, nor how it actually works. But it is true. The evolutionist counters with a correct statement that if you introduce energy from outside the system, you can overcome the tendency for things to break down, which is called entropy. You can overcome entropy. It's overcome by introducing energy from outside the system. That is correct. So the thermodynamics argument in and of itself doesn't work. We have to be extremely careful that we not demagogue the issue. If it's not true, don't try to make it true. If the argument doesn't work, don't try to make it work, because it doesn't work. And that's a part of where being poorly equipped comes in. And there's some good books and stuff out there that can equip people. I personally like J. Palmer Douglas's book, Why We Believe in Creationism. That book touches on a whole lot of different concepts, different elements of this issue in a very objective way. Does a good job, I think, of explaining it. Especially to people who don't really get what science says. And also to people who do, just don't get the other side of it. So they come in with this entropy argument, and it doesn't work. And so they're left kind of scratching their heads, and they're a little bit frustrated, and neither side's really happy with the other side, when in truth, they're both kind of saying the same thing, they just don't realize it. Now, the entropy argument works this way. It's not about the entropy. It's about overcoming entropy. And so when a believer says, second law of thermodynamics, things break down, they neglect to realize that the second law of thermodynamics can be overcome. And that's, of course, the evolutionist argument. Well, it can be overcome. And it's true. It is overcome. It's overcome all the time. That's why we're here. We don't live in entropy. The reason why we don't live in entropy is something called teleonomy. Teleonomy is the life force that was breathed into man when God breathed into him the breath of life in Genesis 2:7. He breathed into him teleonomy. Teleonomy is the thing that allows us to utilize the energy that comes from outside the system in order to overcome entropy. So if you have a tree branch, maybe it's been cut off or fell down, the chemistry in that tree branch is identical to the chemistry in the tree, especially if it's newly fallen. So you can't really talk about chemical processes and the like, because the tree branch has all that it needs to maintain those processes. even though it's been cut down. And people will say, well, it doesn't have water, it doesn't have nutrients. It does for a little while. And it still doesn't overcome the entropy. So why can we overcome the entropy? Because of teleonomy. Teleonomy is that ability that we have that comes in the life force that the Holy Spirit has breathed into us when He breathed the breath of life that allows us to utilize the resources from our environment to overcome entropy, to build. And so anything that has teleonomy can overcome entropy. So the question isn't about the energy that's used to overcome the entropy. The question is really about how can you utilize the energy, because the dead branch gets the same energy that the living branch does. Except the living branch can utilize it and the dead branch cannot, because the living branch has teleonomy and the dead branch does not. So the dead branch is not capable of utilizing the resources, particularly the energy resources from its environment, that the living branch can utilize. So it's about teleonomy. This is what I'm talking about when I say that Christians don't really have a strong grasp on science in too many cases when they try to talk about these things. And unfortunately, they go into these debates, some of them. I'm not talking about people like Ken Ham. He's very good and he's educated in it. I'm talking about the average person. They're usually not educated in it. And they try to educate themselves by reading a book or two, but the books all too often don't really cover all their bases. Again, that's why I like that one book, because it covers a lot of these bases. The evolution issue. Christians say, well, God created everything in complete form, and that is correct. God did create everything in complete form. The fossil record shows us that God created everything in complete form, except that not all forms that were present then are present now. To have been completed in complete form doesn't mean that they are identical today as to what they used to be. But often the Christian who's trying to defend their faith in a very sincere effort, unfortunately not always a thoroughly educated effort, says, well, a dog is a dog then, and it's a dog now, and a mouse is a mouse then, and it's a mouse now, a horse is a horse then, and it was a horse now. Yes and no. Probably dogs weren't even there. Well, how did you get dogs? Do you believe in evolution? Do you know what evolution is? Part of the problem with our talking about evolution, whether we believe it or not, is that evolution is not a thoroughly defined term. First of all, it says evolution of species. That was the title of Darwin's book, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. Origin of species. What is a species? Well, people think to themselves, well, a horse species is something like a horse. And all horses are the same species. And yes, you can have different breeds within the horses, but they're still the same species, and that's relatively correct. Except it's not complete. So we look at a horse and an oyster, and we say these are different species. Fine. We look at a dog and a coyote. Now, usually we can surmise that those are different species. Maybe a better example would be a dog and a bear. They're different species. And we might look at a worm and a caterpillar, and we can see that these are different species. But then we get into areas that are a little bit hazy. You see, talking about the obvious makes things seem obvious. But not everything about an issue is obvious. Only some things about an issue are obvious. But we usually like to stick to the extremes, which are obvious. Alright, let me ask you something. Plasmodium falciparum and Plasmodium vivax, are they the same species? Let me give you a hint. They both cause malaria. Now, if you know anything about biological nomenclature, the way that biologists name things, you will recognize that they are not the same species. The genus name, Plasmodium, is the same. But the species name, Falciparum versus Vivax, are different. Plasmodium falciparum and Plasmodium vivax. Vivax is very unpleasant, but it doesn't kill you. Falciparum is very unpleasant, and it does kill you. The other thing is that they do both cause malaria. Why? Because they're both from the same genus. That genus causes malaria. There's actually four Plasmodium species, all of which cause malaria. And so, we can't necessarily gauge by the outcome what a species is. Let's say that we have a flu virus versus the HIV virus. Are they the same species? Clearly, you would say they're not. But they're both viruses, yes, but they're not the same species. Just like not all mammals are bears. All right, now let's look at a different example. Let's say that you have cowpox virus and smallpox virus. Are they the same species? And most people would tend to say no, they are not the same species because they cause a different disease. One causes a disease in cows and the other causes a disease in people. A cow will not get smallpox, a person does not get cowpox, except for this part. If you immunize a person with cowpox virus, they will not get cowpox, nor will they get smallpox. So you can't protect people from smallpox by exposing them to cowpox, which does not make people ill. They found that with milkmaids. That's how immunization got its start. These ladies would be around cows all the time, and they realized that these ladies don't get smallpox. And so they started investigating it, and they realized that you could immunize. In other words, the lady could catch the virus, have the virus, have the antibodies produced in her blood for the virus, but those antibodies would protect her against smallpox and not only cowpox. So now, are they the same species? The problem is, we don't have a good definition of what a species is. There was a guy in 1949 named Mayer who defined species this way. It's a very poor definition of species, but it's the only one we really have. Two different species are when you have organisms that are pre- and post-zygotically separated and prevented from producing reproductively viable offspring. What does that mean? Zygotes are simply fertilized eggs. And so, pre-zygotically separated means they are prevented from fertilizing an egg. If you have two organisms whereby the egg cannot be fertilized, then they are definitely different species. Post-zygotically separated means after the egg has been fertilized, yes, you could get it fertilized. However, the organism one will either not develop, and that would take place because the genetics are sufficiently different, or they will develop because the genetics are sufficiently similar, but not produce an organism that can itself reproduce its own kind. For example, a mule. A horse and a donkey have sufficiently similar DNA that if a horse egg is fertilized by a donkey sperm, they will produce a mule, but the mule cannot reproduce with another mule to produce a baby mule. So you still have different species. But when you realize that it's very difficult for us to even define a species, then you develop some interesting problems. Because pre- and post-zygotic mechanisms don't necessarily define your species. I've never seen a great chihuahua. Great Danes and chihuahuas, it doesn't happen. Unless you put them in a laboratory somehow and help them out. But in nature, it doesn't happen. So even his definition, because of the pre-zygotic mechanism, has problems. The other problem is there's two types of evolution. One of those types of evolution is not what we traditionally think of as evolution. And perhaps calling it evolution is a bit of a misnomer. But it's still called evolution. Evolution is an enormous umbrella term. It encompasses a lot of different concepts, many of which are correct. If you ask a biologist, what exactly is evolution? He'll tell you it's change over time. And because you can observe change over time, you would have to concede that evolution happens. But then they go into a slippery slope and they say every change is an evolutionary change because it's over time. Therefore, all evolution is right because there is such a thing in biology as change over time. And so they leap to this conclusion that's not legitimate. Now, there are the two types of evolution. Most people do recognize these, at least many do, is that you have microevolution and macroevolution. Macroevolution is the amoeba to Ashley evolution. But there is another type of evolution that is a narrowing down of the gene pool. And that we can observe. That's also called evolution. Personally, I don't think it should be called evolution. I think it should be called something like bradation or something. Because it's the opposite process. Macroevolution says that you start out with a limited certain amount of information within the gene pool, and through mutations and different changes, mostly run by mutations, you expand the amount of information that is present in the gene pool. And they'll say that it takes place on a population level. It does not take place on an individual level. Which is kind of funny because sometimes you see these science fiction shows and this one organism is evolving. It's not evolving. That's not how it works. Not even according to the evolutionists. But an organism cannot evolve. And the evolutionists will tell you that. Organisms will not evolve. Only populations can evolve. And to the measure that they are talking about microevolution, they are correct. To the measure that they talk about macroevolution, they have a lot of problems. So they're saying that information gets introduced into the gene pool by mutations. Well, the way that evolution is set to work is that you get a mutation that is favorable. They'll admit it is a highly unlikely, uncommon event, but because there was so much time available, you could have all the unlikely events actually take place. Now, here's the kicker. In 1982, the Journal of the American Biology Teacher published an article by a biostatistician. And he calculated what it would take, how many mutations, to develop the typical information-bearing segment of DNA. Not the most complex, not the most simple. The average segment of DNA. And he said it would require 10 to the 600 mutations to go from a very simple, whatever amount of organic chem or inorganic or however they want to explain it, it kind of changes from time to time. Elements somewhere deep in the sea to an average piece of DNA. 10 to the 600 mutations. Now, they are claiming that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old and that evolution has only been taking place since the origin of life, which they're saying is somewhere in the ballpark of 250 million to maybe a billion years ago. You've got a few problems with that. If you give them this 4.5 billion year old Earth. Now, I don't ascribe to that. I think you can clearly demonstrate that is not the case in many different ways. And again, that book talks about how to do that. I don't ascribe to that. But let's just give it to them for the sake of the discussion. 4.5 billion years would only allow you 10 to the 17 seconds. That means that every second since the formation of the Earth, you would have to have 10 to the 583 mutations per second. That's a lot of mutations. And so people recognize this and they say, well, there's just not enough time. And so they came up with other kind of theories like punctuated equilibrium brought to us by a Boston College professor. They said, well, evolution takes place really, really fast until you hit a plateau whereby there's a balance with the environment and then it kind of levels off and happens really, really slowly for a while until something dramatic happens and it happens really, really fast again and then it levels off again and happens very slowly. The problem is the fossil record shows no such thing. You still have a problem with the time allotment. Because I don't care how really, really fast you make the evolution, you're still not getting 10 to the 583 mutations per second, even in the fast stuff. How fast is fast then? And then it has to hold on a population level. So it's not that just you get the mutations, you have to have the mutations. Each one of those 10 to the 583 mutations establish themselves within the population to claim evolution. So it's not one organism that has to take this on, it's many organisms that have to take this on. And the idea is that once one organism has it, it can, through reproduction, spread it to its offspring in the following generations. While that could potentially work, I mean, that is how things can spread through populations. The problem with that also is that mutations are not beneficial. We don't know of any case where a mutation is beneficial. Now, good evolutionists would hear that and point to malaria. Because that's the evolutionist gotcha. Hey, there's malaria and evolution. I mean, the mutations that take place in the red blood cells to cause that sickled cell anemia, they protect people from the malaria and therefore it's a positive mutation and it's beneficial, except for one thing. It kills people. If you have full-blown sickled cell anemia, odds are you're not going to make it past 12 years old. Now, some people do with treatment, I realize that, but most people that have full-blown sickle cell have very serious health problems, and at least without treatment, life expectancy is not great. All too often, they don't live long enough to have children. But the sickle cell trait, where one parent has it, the other parent does not, they pass it on to the offspring, and the offspring has a mixture of genes. The one from one parent has it, the other does not. They don't get a full-blown sickle cell anemia. They get some sickling that toughens the coat of the red blood cell, the membrane in the red blood cell, whereby the malaria parasite cannot penetrate it as easily. For them, it offers some protection. Now, here's the thing about that. If you took away the malarial parasite, you would take away the trait. The parasite maintains the trait because people die with sickle cell anemia. The only way that it's maintained is that malaria is protected from, people die from malaria. And so you actually have something of an environmental balance between the trait that is negative and the parasite that is negative. And now you're balancing. And because it does offer some protection, not everybody is killed off. Because it's only a trait, it can survive. But as the numbers game goes, and most of what is evolution is a numbers game, you have to have enough representation of certain alleles, in other words, potential traits, within a population in order for that trait to be maintained. With sickle cell, take away malaria, eventually, it wouldn't take too long, sickle cell anemia is going to disappear. So you've got this balance. People aren't dying of malaria because of sickled cell. But if you have it all the way, you die of the sickled cell. Eventually that trait would simply disappear. So it's a little bit of an artificial thing in as much as it's only there because of the malaria. Take away the malaria, it'll go away. Now, the way that evolution is supposed to take place is mutation, fitness, and adaptation. Mutation brings in, they say, the new information. There's a problem with that. Twofold. Number one, mutations can also take away information. If I have a mutation whereby the strength in my legs is compromised, eventually that mutation will be eliminated from the population simply because of natural forces. I can't deal with predators as well. I can't get food as well, what have you. Now, in today's modern society, we don't have such a problem with that. But even, not primitive, but earlier societies, that was a very big problem not very long ago. When you had, for example, agriculture-based societies and no social support systems. If you weren't able to take in your crop, and or you didn't have family who would help you or friends who would help you, you'd starve. So it's not because cavemen are wild or anything like that. It's just simple cultural changes that now we have these social support systems. However, if you have that same mutation, let's say in an antelope, and that mutation gives the antelope somewhat weaker muscles, then that mutation is going to cause that antelope to get killed. Because the lion's going to come looking for that antelope, and the antelope won't be able to get away as well. So the mutation will leave the population. Mutations weaken organisms. The most common mutation causes cancer. That's not an evolutionary advantage. Evolutionists say once in a while, though, you will get one that strengthens the organism. Okay, let's look at that. Let's say that you have a mutation. Take a look at the evolution of the whale. They used to be called archaeocetes. Archaeocetes were primitive whales. They are said to have evolved from land mammals. What I find is interesting that evolution has land mammals evolving from sea mammals and sea mammals evolving from land mammals. Go figure. Now, archaeocetes are said to have evolved from land mammals. There was a place in Kenya where they found an old watering hole. This was written up in Science magazine several years ago. And they found an area that was an old watering hole, and they found numerous wolf-like creatures would drink from this watering hole. And they found numerous wolf-like skeletons around that watering hole. And it was very clear that the wolf-like creature was designed to operate on Earth. And you can see that. It had teeth like a wolf. It had an ear like a wolf. It had a hip like a wolf. All of those are extremely important in survival for obvious reasons. If you don't have the correct hip, you can't run. If you don't have the correct teeth, you can't eat. If you don't have the correct ear, you won't either be able to find your prey, as in the case of some animals, or you won't be able to hear a predator as they're approaching. And so it's very important for their survival to have all these structures just so. Well, they found an auditory ossicle, which is a portion of an ear, the inner ear. They found a portion of a jaw with some teeth. And they found a portion of a hip. And they took these three portions, something that looked like a wolf tooth, wolf jaw and tooth, something that looked like a wolf auditory mechanism, and something that looked like a wolf hip. They put them together and declared it was a whale. Now, there's a little bit of problem with that. Whales live in water. If you give a whale a wolf-like hip, it won't be able to travel. So it won't be able to get food, and it won't be able to keep from becoming food. That's not an evolutionary advantage, because everything that drives evolution should cause an evolutionary advantage. If it has a wolf-like ear, it has a problem. A mammal's ear is a three-piece structure. And it must be a three-piece structure because of the way that sound waves are carried in air. A whale's ear is a one-piece structure. And it has to be a one-piece structure because of the way that sound waves are carried in water. This difference would create a deaf whale. Now, whales do not see well. And in order to find food, they use something called echolocation. Kind of similar to a bat's way of finding things. There's a structure in their forehead that emits something akin to a sound wave. I don't know exactly the nature of it, but it emits a pulse. And then they hear the pulse come back to them. So you have a whale that's blind, a whale that's lame, a whale that's deaf, and they're telling us that this is an evolutionary advantage. This makes no sense. When they find a fossilized skeleton, for example, they don't find an entire skeleton. It's extremely unusual to find an entire skeleton. They use bits and portions. And if you find, in, let's say, some museum of natural history somewhere, for example, there's one in Houston that's pretty good. There's one in Washington. And you look at these museums and you look at what portion of it, they fill in what they don't have with clay. And you look at what portion is actual fossil and what portion is filled in. It's like a little tiny piece that's actual fossil. And then there's this enormous part that is actually the skeleton or the rest of it. And so they're simply extrapolating. It's really kind of sophisticated guesswork. Now, they are saying that this is advantage. The horse is another one. Everybody likes to point to the books and, oh, you see there's this little horse, and there's this big horse, and there's this bigger horse, and you see the evolution of the horse, and you see it's in my textbook. And this is how they argue. Well, yeah, there's a little thing that is used for that. I mean, these aren't totally arbitrary pictures. But when you really examine what the little horse was, it was a rock badger. But for the longest time, they thought small horses were long extinct until they found people that were still breeding them in Scotland. It's very problematic stuff here. I mean, we can go on about this all day. We really could. I mean, there's a lot of material to work with. Right, that shows this is macroevolution. This is macroevolution. Amoeba to Ashley evolution. Now, on the other hand, you have microevolution. Microevolution does exist. Microevolution says that through means such as mutations, you will eliminate traits from the population. Now, let me give you an example, and let me show you the overlap, and then I will show you the difference. Let's say you want to know how dogs were formed. But, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, there was a test done. And they started selectively breeding foxes. People always thought dogs were from wolves. It doesn't appear that way. They started selectively breeding foxes where they would breed out certain traits. And within 10 generations, they bred an animal that looked a great deal like a dog. Now, that was not macroevolution. That was not an increasing quantity of information in the gene pool. That was eliminating information from the gene pool to focus on, to zero in on specific traits and only have those specific traits represented in the organism. Now, when you take an introductory biology class in college or high school, they talk about things like dominant and recessive genes, genes that show up. You put a dominant with a recessive, they say, and the dominant will show up and the recessive will be masked or hidden by the dominant one. It won't show up. Some things do work like that. However, most things do not. In most cases, you have a dominant and recessive gene. Yes, perhaps that's true, but there is a representation of both taking place. In other words, both chromosomes get represented, not just the one. Remember, you have 23 pairs of chromosomes in human DNA. Those pairs of chromosomes all have the same types of information on them. Like, both have hair color, but it's just different hair color. Well, it doesn't mean because one is dominant that the other chromosome simply goes away. In the cell cycle, though, and this is why you can get dominance and recessive, in the cell cycle, you actually deal with 23 chromosomes, not with 46 chromosomes, until it's time to reproduce. However, chromatids can separate. Traits can jump from one chromosome to another. Chromatids are the two lines that the chromosomes are made of. Every time that you develop an egg or a sperm, you separate those two lines. And so, you can have a rearrangement, not only through the chromatids, but also through the different chromosomes. So yeah, you may have a chromosome whereby something is dominant on this chromosome, but the information on that chromosome can be removed and replaced. Sometimes you have a situation where you have damage to the chromosomes. The cell will send machinery to fix the damage, to cause repair. But if you have too much damage, you don't know what is supposed to be there. So the cell will look at another piece of DNA. In other words, the cell may turn to the partner, the homologue, and take that as its template to repair that, or even cut out a piece. Those are transposable elements. They cut out a piece of DNA to repair. So you've got all these redundant systems to prevent damage from, guess what, mutations. You got redundant systems to prevent evolution from taking place. How did that evolve? So you get to microevolution and you get this narrowing of information whereby you can take a organism that has a great deal of information in it and you can selectively, through environmental pressures or through artificial pressures like when farmers breed animals, you can narrow down the information to get just the information you want. Or you can do it through environmental pressures that'll give you the information that can survive and the other information gets eliminated. Let's say you have two types of genes, really two types of alleles on your genes. And one is for a fat guy and one is for a skinny little guy. And let's say that they live in Hawaii. So the fat guy genes will not do as well as the skinny little guy genes in Hawaii. Because a fat naked guy in Hawaii and a skinny little naked guy in Hawaii, the fat guy is going to have more trouble and the skinny guy is going to be happy. Now here's the thing. You take them into Alaska. And in Alaska, the fat naked guy is going to be happier than the skinny little naked guy. And he'll be able to survive better. Environmental pressure. This is how environment can drive these things. Except you're still narrowing down the gene pool. You didn't put the skinny little naked guy in Alaska and all of a sudden the skinny little naked guy took on fat guy genes. It doesn't work that way. You can take a guy who has genes for both, and he's reproducing with a girl who has genes for both, and they create offspring, and after a certain amount of generations, the skinny little naked children are not going to survive long enough to reproduce, and you're going to have a push toward the fat children offspring. Likewise in Hawaii. The fat children will maybe not reproduce as frequently because they might not survive as well. And the skinny little naked children, they're going to grow up to reproductive age much more readily. And you're going to have a push in the other direction, starting with the same set of information. Well, then there you have it. Microevolution, narrowing down of the gene pool. Problem with the evolutionists is that they say that the fact that there is narrowing down is evidence for the fact that there is expansion. In other words, they see all evidence of any evolution as evidence for all evolution. So they point to microevolutionary evidence. Microevolution does take place. Like I said, it's a misnomer. It should really be called something like bradation. It's a misnomer because it's the opposite process. And they'll say things like, okay, now we have evidence here that evolved. You see, we did manage to narrow down the gene pool of the fox to give us something that looks like a dog. Therefore, information can expand through mutations. That's a logical fallacy. That's saying down takes place, therefore, we have evidence for up. See what I'm saying? That they will call evidence for evolution. There's an archaeologist named Johansson. He made a very good statement, kind of an ironic statement. The actual evidence that we have for evolution taking place would not cover the bottom of a coffin. And he was one of the premier evolutionary archaeologists. This guy is at the top of that field. But he was honest enough, and these people, I'm not saying they're not intellectually honest. Usually, they are intellectually honest. They just ascribe to one view. And so you have this situation where you have evidence for one thing and you're calling it evidence for something totally different. But because it all carries the name evolution, there you have it. Alright, let's say this. You go to China with a tour group. And you have 10 people in your tour group. Let's say you have 5 men, 5 women. And 4 of the men in the tour group are either bald or balding. Chinese people look at that and say, only about 20% of American men have hair. That's the same thing. It's totally different. I mean, we could continue on this. I mean, I'm not even touching really biology yet. Neanderthals. People make this big issue out of Neanderthals. Big eyebrow ridges. Bones, all this hunchback. Arr. Guy with a club and a woman dragging her by her hair. Here's the thing about Neanderthals. Neanderthals were found to only live in areas that are far away from the sun or for some other reason get very little sunlight. So you don't find them in the equatorial regions. The farther you get away from the equator, the more Neanderthals you find. You find virtually no Neanderthals around the equator. Now, there's a guy named Axelrod who was a medical doctor and also an anthropologist. And he wanted to know why this dispersion of Neanderthals is like this, because Neanderthals are supposed to be an intermediate, they really call them a subspecies, between the Homo erectus and Homo habilis and all these pre-human forms, then come Neanderthals and then come modern humans, was the thought. And then modern humans wiped out the Neanderthals, is the thinking. That thinking is problematic. Because we have evidence that is very strong that Neanderthals and modern humans lived together, did business together, reproduced together. Now, when Axelrod got a piece of Neanderthal bone, it's not that easy to do because we don't have that many good Neanderthal samples, but he did manage to examine a piece of Neanderthal bone. He found a very peculiar bone matrix. In other words, the minerals and the insides of the bone had a very particular pattern. It was identical to rickets. Rickets are produced by that bone pattern. Nothing else has that bone pattern but rickets. Rickets will produce pronounced eyebrow ridges, pronounced facial bone structures, certain joints and things. Rickets will produce somebody who looks like a Neanderthal. Rickets is produced by a lack of vitamin D. Vitamin D is produced in your skin through exposure to sunlight. So what they found was people who had rickets because of the environmental conditions that they lived under. But they said, well, these must be some sort of a pre-human species, pre-modern day human species, or subspecies. Because look how different they are. There was an archaeologist, I can't remember which one, but it was a well-known archaeologist, who noticed that the Australopithecus species, that there aren't any men, and there aren't any women. It's always just the one form. And there's Australopithecus africanus, and there's, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, another Australopithecus that is a little bit different in size. And he said, you know, maybe what we're looking at is a male and a female. And that they're not actually different Australopithecus species, there's just a male Australopithecus and a female Australopithecus. Then, a few years ago in National Geographic, another one of these anthropologists says, you know, maybe what we're looking at is the variation that you commonly find within a population of the same species and not actual evolutionary forms. You go to New York City on the subway. Tell me how many different types of people you find as far as their physical appearance goes. You'll find people with different skin color. You'll find people with different hair color. You'll find people of different size, height-wise. You'll find people of different bone structure. You'll find people of different facial features. You'll find a whole host of differences amongst human beings in a New York City subway car. If it was up to the evolutionary anthropologist, each one of those would have been some form of different pre-human species. Because they're different from one another. But the fact is, the differences that exist within the human population as well as populations of other organisms are protective. That's how you avoid things like deadly disease. Wiping out population is because one person is a little bit different than another person. That's why you don't want interbreeding within families. If the genes are particularly strong, then you may actually produce a much stronger offspring, but usually it's not that way. Usually you produce a much weaker offspring that doesn't have near the ability to survive that other people in the population do. And so that variation was built into our genetics to protect the human population and the population of other organisms from being wiped out by various different factors in various different parts of the world. In other words, God built into us the ability to survive not only as individuals, but as entire populations of individuals, no matter where we went. But they call it evolution because there's differences. When God put those differences in, He built them in for survival's sake. There's a lot we could talk about here. I mean, we could go on for the next 2 weeks just talking about these types of topics. Like I said, that book, I really like that book, Why We Believe in Creationism, J. Palmer Douglas. They cover a whole host of these types of topics. Fairly good variety, fairly well in-depth, the coverage there. So I highly recommend it to whoever's interested in this. It's not expensive. You can get it at Amazon. It's pretty cheap, actually. Other questions?